little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics. My name is Bob Frelick.
And I'm Julia Minton.
So can you tell folks a little about the topic?
Yeah, absolutely. So as Bob mentioned, we are on a little holiday break and we're pre-recording this episode. So maybe when I said we're real humans, I meant that in a digital recording sort of way. But anyways, a recent issue of Scientific American caught my eye. It had a big, bold, black letters that fill up the cover that say, "Truth, lies, and uncertainty." That's the September edition of Scientific American.
That's pretty dramatic for Scientific American.
Well, it's why it caught my eye. And yeah, so it gave Bob and I some really great and interesting things to discuss. And that's what we're going to be bringing to you here today. Ideas relating to how we humans construct our reality using our Bayesian brain to integrate incoming sensory information and our preconceived notions of the world around us.
And I'm going to start out with a little story. Now, you might not have heard of Grace and Keir Johnson, but most of us are aware of an article of clothing belonging to Grace Johnson.
How scandalous.
It is. And the couple comes from a tiny island of Colonsay. That's off the western coast of Scotland. And they were happily planning their wedding when the bride's mother just happened to take a photograph of the bride's wedding dress. And after disagreements over the perceived color of their dress in the photograph, the bride posted the image on Facebook. And her friends also disagreed over the color. Some saw it as white with gold lace, while others saw it as blue with black lace. And then, after the wedding, a friend of the family posted a picture of the dress on Tumblr. And from there, it went viral, as they say, with heated arguments breaking out about the color of the dress. You know what? It even has its own Wikipedia page now called The Dress. So you can go to Wikipedia and get more information about this.
That's quite a dress, to be The Dress.
The Dress. Do you remember this whole episode?
Oh, very much. It really was viral is an understatement to how this dress circulated. It was a few years ago. But it was amusing. And I have to say, for all the disagreements about people's perceptions, my feeling was that it was a fairly lighthearted. People would pass it around and say, "What do you see? I see blue and black," and get into these sort of friendly debates about it. I don't think there were too many smackdowns over which color the dress was.
Well, I don't know. Let's take a listen, because this is a clip that talks about this. This is a clip from YouTube. It was posted by BuzzFeed Multiplayer, and it is called "The Dress According to Science."
This is very obviously white and gold.
It's blue. It's obviously blue.
I cannot see blue anywhere in that dress. I don't even know how you could see blue.
It's all coming at me fast.
It's
too,
a
trust
fact
me.
That you're it's smarter if you see it in black and blue.
If you are seeing white and gold, where are you looking at?
I just changed to white and gold!
Wait, no, you're kidding.
This lace bodycon dress has divided the world and threatened to break the internet. Millions have weighed in on what color they see the dress, with around 70% seeing white and gold, and the rest seeing black and blue. And yes, the dress is black and blue. But how is it possible we're all seeing it in two completely different ways? Are people lying? Have we gone mad? We decided to talk with someone who looks at color all day.
When I look at the real dress, of course it's black and blue. But the picture that's been circulating is not has the same contrast. And that tells me that there was some kind of a light that was hitting the dress. And that light quality is a very warm light. What we are really looking at it is the light that's reflecting off of the blacks and the blues. This is the kind of thing that we constantly deal with in color.
Okay, so it is about the color of the light. But how do different minds interpret the light differently? We still weren't satisfied. So we decided to venture out to UCLA's neuroscience department.
I think it's much more likely perception, which is actually to do with the brain. Our brain is really good at filling in information that's not actually there. And so the brain is based on, is basing what it sees on its own interpretation of the image. Okay, and if your brain thinks, I guess, that this dress should be white and gold based on its interpretation of the picture itself, the lighting, the conditions that the picture is being viewed in, it's going to build that image as white and gold. It goes back to the optical illusion issue. You expect the square that looks lighter to be lighter because it's in the pattern where it should be lighter. You can cut the squares out and put them next to each other and show you that they are in fact the same color. But in context, your brain is taking that image and it's making sense of it. Everybody's reality is different. I mean, so understanding that what you see is not necessarily what your neighbor sees, I think this is a really good example of that. And so people, I guess the Latin phrase is de gustibus non est disputandum. There's no accounting for taste. Well, in this case, there's no accounting for color.
I really enjoyed the dramatic music.
I know. It really helps give a little dramatic appeal. And it did spawn a number of studies. Different people came out with different percentages. The one I saw studied 14 respondents to this and found that 57% saw the dress as blue and black, 30% saw it as white and gold, 11% as blue and brown, and 10% could switch between the two. And there was actually a difference between women and older people disproportionately saw the dress as white and gold.
Mm-hmm. And that's 1,400 respondents.
1,400. What did I say?
You said 14, but that's all right. It's just a...
Yeah, that'd be a low sample size with 14. 1,400 respondents. What color did you see?
At first, I absolutely saw black and blue. I was so certain it was absolutely black and blue. And the more this sort of circulated and I talked about it with my friends, I actually kind of made a concerted effort to see if I could see the white and gold. Mm-hmm. And it did switch for me.
It did.
It did switch.
I saw it as gold with white lace. And it's really an amazing thing. Now, as she said, the reality out there. Now, the reality doesn't change. We're not living in a matrix. The reality doesn't change.
We have our own realities.
I'm not trying to bring this up with the idea that we make our own reality. We perceive reality different. It's the difference between sensation and perception.
Yeah, I think this is a really good explanation for why people tell me I'm not good at color coordinating. I think I'm fine at color coordinating.
Neil Seth, who wrote one of the articles in here, this edition of Scientific American.
His article was, "Our Inner Universes. Reality is constructed by the brain, and no two brains are exactly alike."
Yes. He's actually a professor of cognitive and computational neuroscience at the University of Sussex in England. And I listened to another podcast with him on it, and he is actually interdisciplinary. You know, he works with computer scientists, statisticians, cognitive scientists. So I really love that about what's happening now in this whole idea of trying to get deeper and deeper into how we make sense of the world around us. It's cross-disciplinary, and that's so great. I love it.
Well, and it really seems like it's necessary for critical thinking. If we were only talking about logic in a void, on a piece of paper, the more different types of thinking and the more different approaches we can utilize critical thinking with, the more rounded our approaches.
Yeah. And Professor Seth wants to make the point in this article, really, that the reality we perceive is not a direct copy of the external world. I have a quote from him. He says, "The product of the brain's predictions about the causes of incoming sensory signals." It's the product of the brain's predictions. He says also, "In the way that fractured societies in which we live, what is real and what is not seems to be increasingly up for grabs. Warring sides may experience and believe in different realities." It's not that there's different realities out there. It's just that our perception of reality can be quite different.
Absolutely. And I think the dress is a very good demonstration of this, a really kind of non-controversial, although it has its moments, of how we do perceive the world differently. And that's okay. It's what we're working with, because the objective reality is that dress is a certain color.
Yeah. Well, let's hear Professor Seth's words when he talks about this issue.
"The brain is a prediction machine. everything you see, hear, feel, and experience is your brain's best guess about the causes of your sensory inputs. Now, that's the simple idea. Let's unpack it a bit more. Imagine being a brain. Imagine you are a brain. There you are. You're locked inside this bony vault, this bony prison of your skull. And you're trying to figure out what's out there in the world so you can decide whether to eat it or run away from it. Now, there's no light inside the skull, and there's no sound inside the skull. It's dark and it's silent. All you've got to go on as a brain are these electrical signals that come from the senses, which are only indirectly related to things in the world, these blurry things here, whatever they may be. Now, these electrical signals don't come with labels. They don't say, I'm from a coffee cup, or I'm from a beer, or I'm from a cat. They don't even come with labels announcing that I'm from your eyes, and I'm from your stomach. They're just electrical signals. So in order for the brain to figure out what's causing those signals, it has to combine the incoming sensory information with prior expectations about what's out there in the world. And it's this combination of prior expectations that every brain has and the sensory data that leads to our perception. So the brain doesn't hear sound or see light. What we perceive is the brain's best guess of what's out there.
What do you think, Julia?
What's
out there?
That's what's in there. That's the question.
Yeah.
It does seem like it's reciprocal, though. You know, your brain, again, it relies on these signals coming in. But much like the dress, there's a certain amount of interpretation that takes place. I mean, the signals really are the same.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we're going to talk a little bit about the top-down and bottom-up nature of the brain. And I know that we all have been amazed by optical illusions, how we can see something one way and then defocus our eyes a little bit and see it a different way. But optical illusions aren't very good to do on radio. Makes it a little difficult. So we do have a clip here, another one from Anil Seth, talking about something that is a little bit more radio-friendly. So let's take a listen to this.
I'd like you to listen to this and see what you make of it. Anybody think what that is? Dog. Okay, let's listen one more time. So it sounds just like a bunch of noisy whistles, perhaps, maybe a dog. Now listen to this.
I think Brexit is a really terrible idea.
Okay, it's still not that clear, but it's something I definitely do think, in case you're in any doubt. So that was me saying I think Brexit is a really terrible idea. Now listen to the first sound again. I'm going to play you exactly the same sound.
I think Brexit is really
It works. It's good. I always like it when it works. So you can now hear words in what previously just sounded like noisy whistles. One more time. Just have to drive home the message. But what's remarkable here is that the sensory information coming into your brain hasn't changed at all. All that's changed is your brain's expectations about what caused that sensory information. And that changes what you consciously hear, and it can happen so quickly.
Exactly. So our brain is a prediction machine, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sensory information through is really our interface with that outside world, our senses. And as well as our inner world, we have senses that sense our inner world too.
Mm-hmm.
How many senses do we have?
Oh, well, shucks. I don't know. There's hearing and seeing,
yes,
and tasting and feeling and smelling, right.
You couldn't see that, but I pointed it on my nose.
Thanks for the cheat.
Okay, we're all used to five senses, right? But there's really two others that are commonly talked about. One is proprioception. So if you close your eyes.
Do I do that with my proprioceptor?
Yes, you do. You have proprioceptor sensory cells interspersed through your body. And if you close your eyes and take your finger and bring it towards your nose without touching your nose, you can actually, if you try this, you know with your eyes closed where your hand is and that it's approaching your nose. Now, if you touch your nose, you're using your sense of touch,
mm-hmm,
to verify what your proprioceptor cells have already sensed, which is the position of your limbs. So we have sensory cells around our muscle, skeletal system, et cetera, to tell the position of our body. So that's the sixth of commonly talked about sense. And then we have one other, which is
equilibrium.
Equilibrioception.
That's equilibrioception.
Yeah, that's a tough one to say. And that detects acceleration, including the acceleration of gravity. So it takes place in our inner ear, with little crystals in our inner ear. And so we know where down is, and that helps us keep our balance. But people who really study these, you know, they'll describe many more senses, anywhere from 14 to 20 different senses, and parse them out a little bit differently. We don't have to get into all that.
That makes sense. I hadn't thought about that before, but that does make sense.
Yeah. So we have a lot of information coming in. And that's the bottom-up approach, right? It's the information coming in from the bottom. But we also have the top-down, which is through our experiences that we've already had about what's out in the world. We have preconceived set of ideas about what's out there and how to connect that to our sensory information. So there's a top-down approach, our preconceptions, our previous beliefs about the world. And there's a bottom-up, our new information coming in from our senses. And those two are interacting to produce as accurate a view or smell or taste of the world that we can have.
Mm-hmm. And we've talked before about how our predictive brain is necessary for us as people, as animals, in getting through the world, moving through our life, getting out of bed in the morning, assuming, predicting that, in fact, the world is going to be as we left it the night before.
Exactly. And how these are interacting, how this new information modifies our beliefs and preconceptions about things is called the Bayesian approach. And it connects to statistics. We're not going to get into the statistics or Bayesian statistics, but we're going to kind of give the big picture of what the Bayesian approach is. A simplified description of Bayesian approach is that we focus on some particular belief or hypothesis, and then we assign it a probability or likelihood, right? Mm-hmm. And that's called the prior probability. And I'm hearing more and more of that as a buzzword in critical thinking. Somebody will say, well, what are your priors on that? Meaning, to what degree do you think that belief that you're talking about is probably the truth?
Not talking about my arrest record.
No. Priors in this context are not your previous.
Shoo, I was getting worried there for a minute.
With the law.
Bringing up priors, got nervous.
I know. It's a weird term. And then the even worse than that, once you take in new information, and it's got to be evidence that is relevant to this belief, and we're assuming the evidence is true. And if the evidence is true, then you factor that in with your prior probability that that belief is true, and it modifies that probability that the belief is true in one way or another. If the evidence is true, then you might be a higher probability than your original probability, and that's called posterior probability, which is even a more cumbersome word than prior probability. But it's simply said, we look at what our original belief and probability that that belief is true.
Prior
to the evidence that now we're weighing to see how that changes the probability. Mm-hmm. And it may increase the probability or it may decrease the probability, depending on what that new evidence is.
So to be clear, when is this something we do intentionally? Is this something that only people who have been trained in the Bayesian approach do? Or is this something that we inherently do?
I think we naturally inherently do it. But you can actually get very quantitative. We've talked about system one and system two before. Mm-hmm. System one is the intuitive, quick thinking. System two is the more deliberate, thoughtful system that may take into consideration base rates or statistics or some algorithm that we have developed to examine ideas. And those are the two. And I think the Bayesian approach probably is built into us evolutionarily, but we can extend it with our mathematics.
It's a tool that can be refined.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Like a knife that we can sharpen.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah. And it's a good toolbox for critical thinkers. Just to anchor this a little bit in terms of how it's kind of natural for us to use this Bayesian approach, I use an example of I flip a switch in my house. I have a lamp. I flip the light switch. I turn the lamp switch on, and I don't see any light. So I say, well, what is it? So I develop this hypothesis. I don't call it a hypothesis. Just for me, it's an idea. What's wrong with this dang light? Why is the lamp not lighting? Well, it may be that most every time in the past that the lamp didn't light because the light bulb was burned out. So my original hypothesis is, well, something wrong with the light bulb must have burned out. I go get a new light bulb. Now, I always do it this way. When I get a new light bulb, I always check it in another lamp to make sure that that light bulb is good.
A known working lamp. So you're verifying
right.
what you believe to be true. You have a new
yes.
bulb. It should work. You verify that it works. And then
yes.
you put it away for another day.
Yeah. So I collected some evidence that the light bulb is good in this other lamp. So I put it in the lamp that didn't light in the first place and turn the switch or the lamp on, and the light and the lamp doesn't go on. So now what do I do? I can maybe think that maybe it burned out the instant I put it in, right? That can happen.
That could happen.
So I take the light bulb out and put it in my good functioning lamp again, and it's still lit. Mm. So I put it back in my malfunctioning lamp, and it still doesn't work.
So process of elimination.
Right.
We've determined that it's not the bulb.
Right. So my going into it before I got a new bulb, my prior probability might have been that, well, it's 90% chance that it's a burned out bulb. Right?
It seems really likely.
Exactly. Because maybe almost every time I've ever had this experience, it's been the bulb. So now I've got new evidence coming in that a good functioning bulb still doesn't make the lamp work. So my posterior probability of what's happening here went way, way down.
Mm-hmm.
Might
You're
be close to zero.
It. You're yeah. updating the likelihood that
exactly.
it's that bulb.
Exactly. So this is troubleshooting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're all troubleshooters. We know how to do this intuitively. We don't use statistics to do it. We need no calculations. We're doing the statistics in our head on a basis of estimates.
Mm-hmm. And troubleshooting is exactly what I would call it. It's we're all kind of built in to do some of this troubleshooting processes. Again, it's another tool that could be sharpened and refined. Some people train themselves to become better troubleshooters by very consciously going through this effort.
Exactly. And I do want to point out that this Bayesian approach is not just something that somebody made up. It's tied to the mathematics of statistics, and it's statistically defensible, and people will actually do calculations, Bayesian statistical calculations, to actually quantify the amount that this new evidence contributed to our previous probability of some belief.
Which is important when you're doing, you know, more formal inquiry work than replacing light bulbs.
But Julia won't let me get into those statistics on this show because she calls it radio math.
It's, you know, people, we're still trying to convince people that math is fun, but then radio math is just, you know, wah, wah, wah.
So you get the idea, and we can use it intuitively like we do in a troubleshooting example, or we can actually get very quantitative about it. But let's take a listen to how Anil Seth talks about the Bayesian brain.
This typical framework for thinking about these kinds of effects is Bayesian inference, and this is a form of probabilistic reasoning which is applicable in all sorts of domains, not just in neuroscience and medical diagnosis, all sorts of things, finding lost submarines. But in neuroscience, we talk about the Bayesian brain, and it's a way of formalizing Helmholtz's idea that perception is a form of best guessing. And the idea is that sensory signals and prior beliefs can be represented as probability distributions. So, for instance, this yellow curve is the probability of something being the case, maybe that you've got a brief glimpse of an object moving to the right. The sensory data may say something different. It may have a probability that peaks at a different angle of movement. Maybe it's drifting in a different direction. And the optimal combination of the prior and the likelihood, the yellow curve and the red curve, is this green curve, which we would call the posterior distribution. And that represents the best optimal combination of these two sorts of evidence. And the idea is, well, that's what we perceive. Thinking about perception in this way does something rather strange to the way, classically in neuroscience, people have thought about perception. The classical view is that the brain processes sensory information in a bottom-up or feed-forward direction. So this is a picture of the visual system of the monkey, and the idea is that information comes in through the retina, it then goes through the thalamus, it then goes through the back of the brain, and as the sensory signals percolate deeper and deeper and deeper into the brain, they encode or represent progressively more sophisticated features of objects. So you start out at early levels of visual cortex with response to luminance and edges, and then higher up to objects, including other monkeys. What's important here is that the perceptual heavy lifting is done by information flowing in this bottom-up or feed-forward direction. Now, the Bayesian brain idea says something very different. It says that what's really important are the top-down or inside-out connections that flow from the center of the brain back out. And we've known for a long time there's a large number, very large number of these connections, and some descriptions more than flow the other way around. But their function has been rather mysterious. Thinking about the Bayesian brain gives us a nice way to interpret this, which is that it's exactly these top-down or inside-out connections that convey predictions from high levels of the brain to lower levels, back out to the sensory surfaces. So these blue arrows convey the brain's predictions about the causes of sensory signals. And then what flows in the feed-forward or bottom-up direction from the outside in, that's just the prediction error, the difference between what the brain expects and what it gets at each level of description. So this is often called predictive coding or predictive processing in some formal frameworks. And the idea is that minimization of prediction error then occurs across all levels of this hierarchy at the same time, and what we then perceive is the consequence of this joint minimization of prediction error. So you can think of perception as a sort of controlled hallucination in which our perceptual predictions are being reined in at all points by sensory information from the world and the body.
And controlled hallucination. What do you think about that term? That's pretty dramatic.
Oh, it makes me think about The Matrix.
It does. I actually love that, Anil Seth. And by the way, if you want to go to YouTube, he has a TED Talk. He has a number of podcasts. He's a very interesting guy. He talks a lot about consciousness. That's one of his big areas of research, is the nature of consciousness. And you spell his name A-N-I-L, that's his first name, Anil, Seth, S-E-T-H, if you want to find out more of his work. Very interesting guy.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, As we've talked about before, I am not much of a highlighter or underliner, but I went to town on the Scientific American. And I'm trying to, you know, broaden my horizons. You're rubbing off on me, Bob. But he really, I just felt like these two sentences just so like got to the meat of exactly what we have been talking about. The deeper truth is that perception is never a direct window to an objective reality. All our perceptions are active constructs, brain-based best guesses at the nature of the world that is forever obscured behind a sensory veil.
Mm-hmm.
And usually think of sensory as a part of the window to reality, when in fact it's interesting to frame it as actually part of the veil that keeps us from reality.
Yes. And it's the new evidence coming in that we can update our Bayesian prior probabilities about our beliefs and what's actually out there.
Mm-hmm. So should we talk about, before we move on, the a value? We're kind of throwing around what a Bayesian approach for a value statement might be, or...
Yeah, well, I'd like to talk about pareidolia first.
Ooh!
You know, but I do want to say something about his idea that perception is controlled hallucination.
Okay.
I'd rather say hallucination is controlled perception. Because if you say perception is controlled hallucination, that's kind of like opening the door to, well, we make up our own reality out there, right?
Well, but isn't that what we're saying? We're not actively participants in making up our own reality, but it is our own reality.
We write what reality is into our neural networks in our brain, but we don't alter the reality.
True.
By what's in our brain.
It's like reality, we used to joke in philosophy, reality with a big R and reality with a small R.
Exactly. All right, pareidolia. Now, that's another one of those $50 words, and it's something that you think, I don't have, I've never had pareidolia.
Never even heard of it.
We all have had it, and basically...
How can I have something I've never heard of?
Well, I'm going to tell you what it is. It's, if you look up a definition of it, it's misperceiving a vague or random stimulus as something known to the person. Have you ever had that happen to you?
Maybe.
All right.
Well, never heard of it.
Never heard of the term, but I'm sure you've heard of people doing it. I do it all the time. And I'll tell you a couple stories about when I did it. And I'll try to make these shorts because this could last a whole hour when I start telling these stories. One of them is when I was deer hunting. Now, I haven't done a lot of deer hunting. I have some property. My son came up. He and a friend wanted to hunt deer. So we got out and we were hunting deer on the property that I live on. So I set myself up near a ridge top where there's a pond up there. And beyond that pond are some oak trees. There's a whole bunch of nice oak grove up there. And I'm eating sandwich and looking out at those oak trees thinking that would be a great place for deer to come down and hide before they come down to the pond to drink because they could see if there's anybody down there. So, of course, I was being very still. So I'm looking into those trees, and as I begin looking into this one area beyond the branches of some of the oak trees behind them, I began to see that there is a deer up there. And not only am I looking at him, but he's looking at me or her. I can't tell whether he's a buck or a doe at this particular point.
It's okay. We can use they. They the deer.
I can say they. They the deer. But I could see the black on the nose. I could see the ears. And it was very, very motionless. And so I got a little excited, you know, like I may actually get a shot off here today. And so I was very, very quiet. And I watched that deer for about 5 minutes. That deer didn't move at all. And I know, even though I was trying to be motionless, I was moving a little bit here and there. And so I thought that's kind of unusual for any animal like that to not even flutter its ears or make any kind of movements. So I began to suspect, well, is that really a deer? So I very slowly moved from the spot where I was. And when I did that, I noticed that the shadows and the branches just dissolved away. The deer dissolved away. It was just the shadows and the branches. Just to be sure, I gave a big shout, and nothing moved up there. So that's an example of pareidolia.
It's a very good example.
And another, for me, these are examples, and the reason I'm telling these is because they amaze me when they happen. How could I have seen this deer and be so mistaken, finding there was no deer there? I live very close to a creek, a small creek. And every once in a while, I'll go outside and I will hear voices down there at the creek. And I swear they're talking, sometimes two voices, sometimes they're talking to each other. And I'll think, it's very unusual to have anybody down in that area. It's not very accessible. And part of my brain will say, that's just the creek. Another part of my brain will listen intently, and I swear that I can actually hear certain words being said or even songs being sung. Every time that's ever happened, I've gone down to look, and as I get closer and closer, I just hear the burbling brook.
It's like the opposite of the example we gave earlier.
Exactly.
And so you've verified this a number of times. It's more than just once. You've gone down, you've
yes.
looked around, you've made sure that you, in fact, were just kind of hearing the static of the bubbling creek.
That's right.
And your brain still comes up with it sometimes.
It does. It'll happen time and time again. And I know that nobody's down there. It's very unusual. I have never found any. So my prior on that is it's just the creek. But my brain is kind of fits it into there's some kind of language being spoken there. So it fools me, and it continues to fool me, and it will fool me again.
Yeah, my the example I can think of, it's not quite as exciting, but I have a kale plant. It's actually, some people call it a kale tree, mm-hmm. because it's a perennial and it's been growing for maybe 6 years now. And I hold it up with some bamboo and stuff. So the top where I'm harvesting the kale now is about 6 feet tall.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's I love it. I love it. Anyways, that's beside the point. And sometimes the wind kind of knocks it around a little bit, and it'll just swing just a little bit into the view of my window in the living room. And because the only part that swings into my, usually my peripheral view, is at about 6 feet high, and it's just a little bit of that kale, and my brain, like every time, says that's a face. That's a shadowy face peeking in. And even when I know it's a blustery night, and the wind's out there, and, you know, I harvested some kale just a few minutes ago, it still gets me. And also, I will add, when I watch scary movies, it's much more likely to get me.
Yes. And we all have those instances and those memories of being a child and being scared and then going to our room and hearing noises and thinking it's believing very strongly that it's a boogeyman or whatever. But you're going to love this. You had an episode of peripheral pareidolia.
Mm-hmm. It's much more common in the peripheral kind of vision.
Yeah.
And it's usually shadowy figure looking in, but I look at it directly, gone.
Yes, and some other people may see that and have that happen, and because they have a belief that there are ghosts, there are other worlds, there are other dimensions, that they will actually use that as evidence that that's what they saw.
Mm, that makes sense. It does.
And we are all different. This is one of the things that came out of this article. Let me just read this quote, and then we'll talk about a little bit about how beliefs and critical thinking come into this whole picture. Anil Seth in this article says, quote, "This is why understanding the constructive creative mechanisms of perception has an unexpected social relevance. Perhaps once we can better appreciate the diversity of experienced realities scattered among the billions of perceiving brains on this planet, we will find new platforms on which to build a shared understanding and a better future, whether between sides in a civil war, followers of different political parties, or just two people sharing a house and faced with washing the dishes."
Oh, I could have started wars over washing dishes. but that is a very good point,
yeah.
Is that we do, in a small R way, live in our own realities a little bit. We have life experiences that contribute to our Bayesian approach of making sense of the world. We continue to have more experiences that updates those posterior probabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And that is valid. That is valid, the way that we perceive our small R reality and walking through this world. And I think he makes a very good point in that we should keep that in mind when interfacing with each other, you
know?
Exactly.
Yeah, and we've talked about civil dialogue. We had a 3-episode series on civil dialogue. This kind of helps me when I'm getting in a discussion with someone who thinks completely different than I am. And maybe even their beliefs are affronts to my beliefs. I consider them to be superficial or completely off base. You know, I call them wacky beliefs. And yet this sort of idea that we're talking about on Thinking Clearly Now and these articles in Scientific American give me an ability to sort of step back and appreciate that person's reality, the construction of reality in their head, is quite different than mine. And their worldview, the basic assumptions that they make about the way the world is, can be completely different than mine. And so it makes it more important for us to find the common ground that we can agree on, the parts of reality that we can agree on, and use that as a base to go forward.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And for me, laying some groundwork for mutual respect. When someone says, and we've heard this before, but I saw it with my own eyes. Mm-hmm. That may very well be true.
Yes, yes. And when you start talking about the constructive nature of our memory of what we saw, too, that throws a whole other variable
in there. Whole other variable.
Yeah. So we got to cut each other a little bit of slack. But we are a program about critical thinking, which is looking for evidence-based beliefs. In other words, whatever the belief is, looking for evidence that might support that belief or disconfirm that belief, not support it. Looking at a whole range. That's why we use this term robust search for evidence in our definition of critical thinking.
Yeah, and that applies to us. When I say I saw it with my own eyes, maybe I should take a moment to pause and consider what it is I actually in fact saw, because it was a blue and black dress. I'm certain of it.
No, it was actually white and gold.
I saw it with my own eyes.
Yeah.
It's blue and black.
But this is not a values-based argument. This is a description of the way the world really is, and you are actually right. The dress is.
Well, yeah, I knew that, if you just listened.
If you look at the dress itself, not a photograph of the dress.
Right.
The dress is.
Blue and black. You can order one online.
You're right. So I will agree that I was mistaken.
But you saw it with your own
eyes. I saw it with my own eyes. That's right. And I couldn't change it to any other color. Hmm. You know, there are some interesting explanations as to why that happened. But you can actually search on the internet for that. There's a lot of stuff on the internet on the dress. So we've kind of gotten into this idea that if something so basic as the color of a dress, or whether there's a deer behind the trees, or voices coming from the creek, if something that basic, which is really of the world out there, if we can be fooled by those kinds of things because of the top-down nature of our expectations from our brain, it can actually alter the way we perceive the sensory information coming in. That's very, very basic. If this whole idea comes into play in something that basic, then when it comes to our more abstract beliefs, you know, it's not much of a leap to say the same thing is going on with our more abstract beliefs.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely imperative that we take a look at it and consider that we, in fact, we have our own interpretations and our own perceptions of things that contribute to these sort of value-based perceptions. I was going to give an example of, I guess I'll do it now,
sure.
Of I was trying to come up with a value-based sort of thing. They're in our everyday lives, but let's see, something that gets thrown around sometimes is, you know, people on food stamps just don't work hard enough. They're not hard workers. They're lazy, and they want a government handout.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, there was a holiday reunion. I got together with my family, and I discovered my aunt and her whole family is on food stamps because my uncle got laid off from his job and they can't, you know, afford the bills and everything. And so they took, you know, whatever help they could to stay on their feet. And I updated my information. I said, wait a minute. I know my aunt. I know my family. They are some of the hardest working people I know. In fact, my cousin's out there mowing lawns this weekend, you know, at minimum wage, just to try and contribute to the family. They're not lazy. They're not wanting a government handout. In fact, they would like to get off food stamps. That's a sort of, I think, a good example of how these perceptions might play out in a political or a societal sort of context.
Yeah. And we could extend that in terms of our ability to initiate critical thinking on that idea by doing a study to find out, because what swayed you in that argument, or this person that you're talking about in that argument, is a single case, anecdotal case.
Mm-hmm. And a personal one.
And a personal one. But those single anecdotal personal cases are very impactful to us.
Mm-hmm.
People change their opinion, completely reverse their opinion when something happens in their family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the death penalty. I might be against the death penalty until someone in my family does something where they're subject to the death penalty, and then it gets me thinking about the death penalty, and I may completely reverse my belief on that. So we've talked a lot about belief change. This show is about how we form our beliefs. Mm-hmm. We are advocating for using evidence-based beliefs, evaluating all the evidence, and keeping an open mind so that our beliefs could change.
And approaching that, there is, before I even have to have that new evidence provided about my aunt, which again is a personal piece of information, to even just consider that there might be that possibility. What if I talk to someone who receives food stamps? I wonder how that would change. That's what we've talked about, is keeping an open mind.
Yeah.
That there may be, because I will also say the other possibility to changing our mind is to digging in and to saying, well, my aunt's the exception. I mean, clearly she's different than the rest of them. And I'm sure that the large R reality is somewhere in between.
Yeah. And it's all about balance. We want to keep an open mind, but not so open that our brains fall out. In other words, we want to look at the evidence. And I think we can move to sort of another topic, another article in Scientific American. It's related. A lot of this interest in psychology, economics, anthropology, all the various sciences, artificial intelligence, a lot of the renewed interest in these kinds of ideas that we talk about on Thinking Clearly has come about because people are so politically polarized in this country. Mm-hmm. We're subject to seeing fake news, misinformation, disinformation abounds on the internet. And people will pass on posts that they haven't even read sometimes because they...
Most posts that are passed on, yes, weren't read by the poster.
The highest percentage of posts weren't read, but they see, person sees the headlines and goes, that's something I want to pass on to my friends to show them that this is what I believe, mm-hmm, in. That's identity protective cognition. And it has to do with our identity with various groups that we affiliate with that have similar ideas to us and similar beliefs. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of that polarization. We live in that era of being
truth,
able to trust.
Lies and uncertainty.
Exactly. They got the headline. And
I would go so far as to say, you know, you mentioned like, you know, in the internet, we are living in all kinds of fake news, misinformation, disinformation.
Yes.
It's not just the nature of the internet that is something that comes with. It is actually a strategy that is happening right now, which the reason I mention that is it is more important than ever that we exercise these sorts of tools, because it is a strategy to try and create disruption and chaos and turn us on each other.
And that brings us to another article. It's one at the kind of beginning of this September Scientific American edition that we're talking about.
By the editors, yeah.
Yeah, this is by the editors. It's called When Like is a Weapon. And it was written by the Board of Editors of Scientific American. It discusses how the recent disinformation campaigns using social media have been sweeping, and insidious is the word they use, and then goes on to say, here's a quote from that article, using memes, manipulated videos, and impersonations to spark outrage and confusion, their targets transcend any single election or community. Indeed, these efforts aim to engineer volatility to undermine democracy itself. If we're all mentally exhausted and we disagree about what is true, then authoritarian networks can more effectively push their version of reality, playing into the us versus them dynamic that makes everybody more vulnerable to false belief.
I'm not sure what I have to say about that.
Well, that must mean you agree with it strongly.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I mean, I guess that's why I'm just like, yes, of course.
Yeah. The internet, social media is a double-edged sword. When the internet first came on board, I think most of us that saw the usefulness of the internet thought, wow, information at our fingertips.
Information can be free and we can all become smarter.
Yes, we can free ourselves from disinformation. But that's not the way it's turned out.
I still have a glimmer of hope.
Oh,
I have,
yeah,
a glimmer of hope.
Well, sure. It's a new, relatively new technology for us.
Mm-hmm.
It's developing.
Yeah. And so I think it's also important to understand the differences. Misinformation would be you sharing the dress and telling all your friends, look at this beautiful white and gold dress.
Yeah. It's something I believe. I was wrong, But
in, and people might agree with you.
Yeah, but in good faith, I pass that wrong information because I actually believe it on to my friends.
That's, you saw it with your own eyes.
That's misinformation, right? Mm-hmm. What's disinformation?
Disinformation would be, disinformation would be me wanting to, if I was politically motivated and I didn't want people to have food stamps, I didn't think that was a program the government should offer, I could be telling people that people are getting on food stamps by forging documents that who aren't eligible, that they're wasting their food stamps on alcohol and pizza and Wagyu steak. And those are things that I would intentionally be saying to further my political idea.
Yeah. It would be making up stuff, right? I mean,
yes.
you're essentially insane, making those claims. You are, without checking the research, you are making up generalizations that sounds like it came from some sort of research and has some sort of evidence-based credibility.
Right. When in fact, food stamps, by law, you cannot buy alcohol or cigarettes or pizza delivery.
Yeah.
Those are things that are actually integrated into the system. So I'm spreading lies, things that I know.
That you know are lies.
Not to be true, because I want other people to share the same ideology I do.
Yeah. So motivation becomes important. If you're passing on misinformation, maybe you haven't checked the information well enough and you should check it out, but you pass it on in good faith. Disinformation is where you're trying to manipulate someone, and there is so much of that that's happening mm-hmm. on the internet. And
like I said,
it's always happened, but it's happening to a larger degree now because we have this amazingly powerful technology.
Mm-hmm. And it, like I said, is absolutely a strategy today, unfortunately, in trying to sway people into certain types of thinking.
Yeah. Well, we're getting close to the top of the hour. And I do want you to know that this September edition of Scientific American, if you're interested in critical thinking and these kinds of issues, is worth getting. And in fact, from one of these articles, we had our guest from last month.
That's right, Kaylin.
Kaylin O'Connor, who did some modeling of the social dynamics of transferring information from one social group to another. And we're probably going to have some future guests that I'm looking into from this edition of Scientific American.
Mm-hmm. And it really exemplifies something you mentioned earlier and we talked about last month, which is the sort of interdisciplinary thinking. We often have philosophy professors, and we've talked about logic and constructing arguments, and here we are finding ourselves in Scientific American. It requires all these different avenues of thinking.
It's an exciting time. I thought the 60s was an exciting time, but this is a very exciting time to be alive
mm-hmm.
and be thinking critically.
That's right.
Well, Julia, as always, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure discussing these things with you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, absolutely. A pleasure as always, Bob. I really, truly enjoy doing this. And I hope that our audience engages with us and lets us know what they think and lets us know if they have ideas for future topics and guests.
Yeah, and I'll post some links on our Facebook page that have to do with Anil Seth and some of the issues that we've been discussing. Mm-hmm. So until next time,
keep thinking
clearly.
This program was produced in KMUD's Redway Studios and is provided courtesy of KMUD, People-Powered Radio.